This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You are listening to Word for Word Across Australia on your community radio network. My name is Sue Wilkinson and joining me today is Peter Forty. Dementia is the term used to describe the symptoms of a large group of illnesses which cause a progressive decline in a person's functioning. It's a broad term used to describe the loss of memory, intellect, rationality, social skills and physical functioning.
Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, accounting for between 50 and 70% of all dementia cases. Dementia can happen to anybody, and it's more common after the age of 65. However, people in the 30s, 40s and 50s can also have dementia. An estimated 269,000 Australians currently live with dementia.
Each week there are 1,500 new cases of a dementia in Australia, and it's the third leading cause in death in Australia after heart disease and stroke. There's more than 16,000 people with younger onset dementia, that is people under the age of 65.
3 years ago, Melbourne couple Tony and Paul turned to a new chapter in their lives when Paul was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's.
Today on Word for Word, we're joined by Dr. Marie Farrow from Alzheimer's Australia and also Tony and Paul, who will share their story and insights into what it is like to live with and have a partner with Alzheimer's. Welcome to Word for Word.
Thank you.
Marie, those facts are rather disturbing.
Yes, they are.
So tell us about, is diagnosis increasing for a start, or is it we're just becoming more aware of what the symptoms are?
Well, yes, diagnosis is increasing, and that is really because we are becoming more aware. So as in the past, when an older person might have started displaying symptoms of, you know, forgetfulness and not being able to look after themselves, people would have said, oh, well, they're getting old. That's what we expect. Whereas now we realise that it's not a normal part of ageing to be severely affected by these things. And so people are seeking help more often and we're getting an increase in diagnosis. We're also getting an increase because the population is ageing. We're living longer, so more people are going to be affected by dementia.
So what are the symptoms of dementia?
The symptoms vary quite a lot. So for Alzheimer's disease, which as we've said is the most common form of dementia, one of the most prominent early symptoms is forgetfulness. So people start to not be able to remember new information. They can still remember what happened, you know, in the past, but they start to have trouble learning new information. So they forget appointments and forget conversations that they've recently had and things like that. Symptoms can also occur in the areas of language, attention, the way we perceive our environment, sights and sounds. So any brain function can be affected. But memory is a very prominent one for Alzheimer's disease.
So it's, as people get older, and particularly my age group in my upper 60s, you tend to start forgetting the odd thing here and there. Is that a sign of dementia?
No, not necessarily. Unfortunately, as we get older, our brain does start to slow down and not work as well as it did when we were young, which is the same for the rest of our body. It's just an unfortunate thing that we all have to deal with as we get older. So it's quite normal to start to find it a little bit more difficult to process new information, take a little bit longer to work things out, and be a bit more forgetful than we were when we were younger. That's quite normal. When it starts to interfere with your daily life, so really starts to cause significant problems, it's then that it might be a sign of dementia. But there are lots of other things that can cause that to happen as well. So, you know, our message really is that if people are concerned at all, they should go and talk to their doctor, and the doctor's the best person to figure out what is going wrong, if anything, and do something about it.
Now, before we catch up with Tony and Paul, I want to understand, because I'm not clear on it, and I think a lot of people aren't clear on it, and Peter and I were chatting earlier about trying to understand a visual structure of what dementia is and where Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and it all fits in. So could you give us a visual diagram of dementia? I'm assuming dementia is the umbrella term.
That's right.
And then underneath that, could you please explain how that works?
Yeah, sure. So as you've said, dementia is an umbrella term, and it's the term we use that describes the symptoms. So memory loss, problems concentrating, etc. Now, those symptoms can be caused by a very large number of different diseases, illnesses, disorders that affect our brain. So, as we've said, the most common is Alzheimer's disease, people with Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease. There are conditions that are reasonably common called dementia with Lewy bodies and frontotemporal dementia. So all of these things are diseases of the brain. So there's actual pathology and damage that's going on inside the brain that damages brain cells, damages their ability to communicate with each other, and that's where our problems with memory and thinking come in, because, you know, our brain isn't working as it should.
Now, these are all different conditions.
They are.
So they're very, very different.
So yes, anything that goes wrong with the brain is called dementia, is it?
Not necessarily. Very, very roughly, you can divide brain function into two different parts. So there's what's called our motor function. Our brain controls our movement, and then there's our cognitive function, which is all our thinking functions, language, memory, attention, etc. So it's called dementia when it's something that affects those cognitive functions.
Okay, now let's catch up with Tony and Paul. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello.
Tell us, let's go right back, because I love putting people on the couch. It's one of my favourite things.
Should have been a psychiatrist. So.
You know what, I did consider it. When did you first meet?
We met something about 23 years ago now. I went to a gym and saw Paul, and things developed from there.
Okay, so was that the love at first sight kind of thing?
No. In fact, we had quite a fairly long, one might in the old days call a courtship, I suppose. It was very slow. We slowly got together, and after about a couple of years, we decided that we'd move in together, bought a house, and we've been in that house now for 22 years.
Do I detect a Southern English accent?
You
there?
Do, yes, from Dorset.
Mm-hmm.
Poole.
From Poole.
Poole in Dorset.
So tell us about those early years together. We're talking about 23 years ago. There are a lot of the barriers to being out and proud and gay. They were quite, the walls were quite high then.
They were. I didn't find them a problem. Probably since we've had to become involved more with governments and things as Paul's developed Alzheimer's, I think perhaps those things have come to the fore. But at the time, it just didn't worry us. We just got on with our lives. We moved in, all the neighbours accepted us. Paul, what do you think?
It was pretty easy, really. We didn't have any major hassles with being gay or ashamed of it or anything. At the same time, we didn't want to throw it in anyone's face. So we just lived a normal life, and occasionally we took a picture off the wall, but that's about as far as we went.
Nothing much has changed then.
No.
Okay, now let's go into your relationship, I guess. You've had 23 years together, and over that, the health of you, Tony, wasn't that good about 10 years ago.
No, that's right. I had cancer of the small bowel. I had cancer of the small bowel, and they took the offending cancer away, and touch wood, I've been very well ever since. Great stuff. So both of us, Paul had an infection in his lungs, which could have been fatal if there hadn't been a new drug, which had only been launched about 18 months before he caught this particular problem. And we got through that. So that was okay as well. And then not only did Alzheimer's come along, but a year after that, Paul was diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Wow. Okay, well, let's go into that. Let's talk about what led up to the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Were there initial things that either of you or both of you noticed? Or, I mean, it's great in hindsight. You can look back and go, ah, now it all makes sense. But what were those initial things? Because I'm sure people are listening now going, oh, well, maybe that applies to me, or that applies to my grandmother or my partner. So if you could help out with that, that would be great.
Well, perhaps I should say, as the partner, I saw nothing. But Paul came home one day, he'd been to the doctors, and he'd mentioned this to the doctor. Why? I'm still not absolutely sure. I think maybe there are one or two issues at work. Paul, would you like to comment?
I kept forgetting things, and I was helping out and working at a health club. Not a health club, a squash courts and all that stuff. And I started forgetting things. And now when you got, you know, 20 people every 15 minutes coming in, you got to know what you're doing. And I was standing there like a gig and just smiling at everyone as they came through. And I thought, oh, something's wrong.
But you knew that you were forgetting things that you shouldn't really be forgetting.
Yes, yeah. And I didn't know what to do about it. So we went to the doctors. And he was very good, and he referred us to St. Vincent's?
No, a clinic in the Austin, the memory clinic at the Austin. But they, it's quite funny, they forgot to make the first appointment. And I didn't think there was an issue in the first place, so I didn't do anything about it. And I'm very pleased to say that the doctor remembered about 9 months later, he remembered to ask Paul what happened when he went to the memory clinic. Mm. And Paul said, oh, I haven't been. So he made sure that they made an appointment.
Hmm. And it was by accident they found that I might have Alzheimer's. And I've got to tell it.
Yeah, shall I explain?
Please
do. I keep missing things.
Perfectly reasonable and acceptable.
They sent an appointment to Paul. And I must say the best thing that they said in that appointment was, you must bring somebody else along with you. And I think that was even in capitals, or it was in bold type. So I thought, well, I'd better go along. And we sat down with a specialist at the memory clinic. And Paul, he began asking Paul to tell him the story. And suddenly I realized that, in fact, there was an issue. But the trouble was, at home, I had taken over. And I had no comprehension that I had taken over whatsoever.
So it was a very gradual thing.
It was a really horrible feeling, to the extent that they took Paul off after he'd explained it all to do some cognitive tests to start to find out what was wrong. And there was a nurse in the room. She said, I think, Tony, you better come with me. You look very grey. Mm. And she sat me down and said, have a cup of tea. I said, well, I can't get over the fact that I didn't realise there was a problem, but I now know it's because I had taken over. And she said, you're not the first person to say that in this room.
I notice Dr. Marie's been nodding her head. Obviously, I'm assuming this is a textbook progression that you're here listening to now.
Yes, it is very much. What Paul and Tony have been talking about is quite typical of the early stages of Alzheimer's disease.
In saying that you didn't notice and you just took over, I mean, I guess we do that. We all have our roles in the relationship. You know, I'll do the cooking and you do that part, and that sort of melts out over time anyway. So what is the difference then in taking over?
Well, I've begun to take over practically all the arranging of things and remembering things, the paying of the bills and those sorts of things. And probably I was doing a lot more of that administration than would be normal for one partner to do.
Right.
And it had all happened slowly. And I think it probably does happen in other in other partnerships, but I didn't understand the reason for it. I'm just a controller, I suppose, and I had just stepped in and filled the gap. that was beginning to develop.
Paul, when this was the earlier days and you were noticing that your memory was going and you noticed at work things were different, did you notice that you were taking a step back in the relationship, in the bill paying and all that sort of stuff?
Yes, I did, because... look, I've lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Well, we can help. We can get Tony to help fill in for a minute.
I think Paul obviously realised that there was both problems at home and at work, and that's why he went to the doctor. He was able to identify some of these things. Perhaps he was trying to tell me, I don't know during that time, perhaps he was trying to tell me there was an issue and I wasn't listening. But I just found it so easy to take over, and I'm still extremely surprised about how easy I found it.
Mm. I think we all do that, though, don't we, Peter?
Mm.
In our relationships, find that rhythm and what one person's good at, that person does, and then...
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
It's a natural progress.
Usually my partner is good at that kind of thing.
You're listening to Word for Word Across Australia on your community radio network. We've been talking about Alzheimer's. We've been talking to Tony and Paul about their journey, and, of course, to Dr. Marie. Is that all right? We just call you Dr. Marie?
Yeah, that's fine.
From Alzheimer's Australia, about Alzheimer's. Now, something important that you touched on before was taking someone to the doctors with you, or taking someone to their specialist, your appointment, and you're saying that that's extremely important.
Yes. Yeah, we find that extremely important. We've done it ever since Paul started to go to the memory clinic. In fact, I think our records are better than the medical records, because they frequently ask us to tell them when certain things happened. That's good. We could point it when I get home after going to an appointment. I just add some notes to the notes that I took to the consultation in the first place about what happened, and then they're very useful for next time, because you can review what went on before you go to the next appointment. And believe me, there's lots of appointments to go, particularly during the diagnosis process.
I'm sure. Paul, if you were to go to an appointment on your own, mm-hmm. without that support, what do you think might happen?
I'd get it all up the pole. I wouldn't know what I was doing. I try and remember, but you tried and do something, it doesn't work. Another thing is, I did a course for computers once for 2 weeks and got a fabulous little, what do you call it?
Certificate.
Certificate. And 2 days later I couldn't work the machine, and I still can't.
Right.
And so if I came home and had to write down things, after a while with writing I go into a scrawl. So I've got no chance.
Right. So you need somebody. Which brings me into the point, Peter, of what happens to these people who don't have the loving partner, who don't have someone in the family or a friend, partner, whatever, to take them to these appointments.
Yeah, well, maybe Dr. Marie might have something to say about that.
Yeah, it is a very important issue, and the doctors do rely very heavily on what we call informant reports. So that may be a spouse or another member of the family, or even a close friend, someone who knows the person well, who can describe what's been changing. Because dementia is all about changes. It's the person not being able to do things they used to do anymore. So you really do rely on someone who knows them well. And the person who has the illness may have difficulty explaining things to the doctor. So, of course, there are, unfortunately, people in our society who don't have anyone like that they can rely upon. So then it really comes down to the medical profession to try and do their best for those people.
I'm sure they slip through the net, though.
I'm sure they do. It is a very real issue.
So what's happening at the moment to stop this happening?
Well, I don't think there really is anything, unfortunately, that's happening. It's not so much an issue for the medical profession or the dementia sector. It's a societal issue, and it's only going to increase as our population is ageing. We're going to have more and more older people living on their own, and it's up to all of us really to take care of our friends and family.
Tony and Paul are in a loving relationship, and obviously you work together as a team. Now, these people who don't have anybody, they're missing out, the information's going askew, it's not all happening for them. If they need to go into a facility of some sort of care, and it's, you know, that's a progressive step, what's out there?
There certainly are things out there. So if a GP or really any other service that a person might be utilising notices that there are significant issues, they can call in an aged care assessment team. So they're government-funded teams who come in and assess the person at home and work out whether they are still able to live at home, and if so, what extra services do they need? Do they need Meals on Wheels and other services to help them stay at home, or have they reached a point where they really need to go into residential care?
Because there are councils do something like this, don't they, keeping an eye on the elderly?
Yes, exactly. There are various services out there. It often,
they just have to know about it, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. The people need to know about it themselves, or you know, someone else who has contact with them needs to report it to the appropriate people.
When we're talking about younger onset Alzheimer's or young, what happens to these people who perhaps need a care facility? Are they ending up in old aged care facilities?
They certainly are, because we don't have any alternatives at the moment. So it's something that affects people with acquired brain injury and all sorts of other issues, where they may be at a younger age but not able to, you know, live independently in the community and need that residential care. And unfortunately, yeah, we are seeing them end up in old age nursing homes.
It's just that just, Peter, I don't know about you, but that disgusts me. It absolutely disgusts me that we don't have facilities tailored to specialist needs. We've got cancer treatment centres, we've got old age facilities, we've got childcare, but yet something with the astounding numbers I was reading, 269,000 Australians currently live with dementia. Now, obviously not all of those people need high care facilities, but there must be a high percentage of those people who need facilities.
You would think so,
and you would probably be able to tell us more about that, Dr. Marie, but it astounds me that our society doesn't have anything set up.
Well, most of those 269,000, of course, are elderly people. We have maybe 15, 16,000 people in Australia with younger onset dementia, so they're people under 65. So the, you know, the residential aged care sector does need to start thinking about how we deal with this issue. And certainly there are people looking at, can we establish residential facilities for younger people? One of the, you know, the big difficulties is that there, you know, if you want to term it as a market, there's not a huge market for it, because there are not that many younger people within each, you know, city or locality that require that high level care to, you know, have the government or the private sector set up those facilities everywhere, you know, to have one around every corner. It's, you know, not economically viable, unfortunately. But there certainly are people, and we have a group here in Melbourne called the Lovett Foundation, who are trying to raise money and awareness to set up a facility for people with younger onset dementia.
I think even if it's for one person, it's not good enough that it's not out there. Because if there's always one, there's always another. Tony and Paul, since the early diagnosis, which was 2006, in 2007 you were diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
With Parkinson's.
Sorry, Parkinson's.
Yes.
Tell us about that. What led up to that moment?
Well, I think I could probably explain that. I think basically it was sitting there watching television and noticing Paul's right hand had developed a tremor. And I thought, oh, we need to do something about that. And we both talked to our GP. He referred us to a specialist at St Vincent's. We went to the specialist after a few weeks, and that afternoon, much to my horror, he diagnosed Parkinson's, because the diagnosis was so rapid. Whereas with Alzheimer's, it had taken us 2 years to actually get to a diagnosis. And that was the traumatic bit. The Parkinson's was easy.
What is Parkinson's?
Parkinson's disease is another brain disease. It affects a certain area of the brain that controls our movement. So the common symptoms are a tremor, as in Paul's case. Also, people's movement slows down, and they have trouble initiating movement. So if they're sitting, they can start to have difficulty, you know, getting out of the chair, and or even when they're standing, have trouble initiating walking to the other side of the room or wherever they want to go. So it's a motor disease.
Peter?
Yes, I was wondering about you, Tony, because understandably, you know, the focus is on Paul and how he's coping. How does it affect you?
Well, it obviously affected me in a massive way. I had already retired when Paul was diagnosed. We wanted to do
which was a good thing, really,
which was a wonderful thing, actually, a very good thing. But we wanted to do a lot of things, and we wanted to travel. So as soon as Paul was diagnosed, we started travelling, and we travelled for 2 years. We did something like 12 cruises. We went around the world several times, went to see so many places that we wanted to see, until the medical profession started to say, well, you need to slow down a bit. You don't need to cross so many time zones in one go. And if you do, you need to have a long rest. And we do know of people who have in fact worsened the, or no, accelerated the progress of the diseases by getting themselves overstressed. So we have eased back, but we're very pleased that we did all that in the first couple of years. We seem to be dashing around the world to so many places, but it's amazing. We frequently say to ourselves, oh, we've been there, when we see it on television, and quite frequently. So we're very pleased we did that. We had to do it in a bit of a rush. All the time, of course, I've continued to do the administration of the house and those sort of things. Paul still does a lot of the cleaning and gardening.
What about, you know, your feelings about how you handle things? Do you get angry, upset, or...?
I have surprised myself, actually. Obviously, I do get angry and upset sometimes. I get angry and upset that it's all happened. But it's happened, and we've just got to put up with it. I think that probably people such as ourselves may find it a little bit easier, because people who are gay have had to go through a very difficult situation when in their teens. They've had to recognise that they're a little bit different than other people, that life has dealt them a different set of cards to other people, and they have had to come to terms with that. And it's very much, I've been able to use that, you know, this is the way our lives have gone, now we must accommodate that, and we must live with it in exactly the same way as when I was younger. I actually had to live with the set of circumstances that I've been dealt in life anyway. And I think that may be easier. I think it might be a little more difficult for people who have not come across a stressful situation before to cope with that.
That is quite profound. That is quite profound if you think about what you have just said. And I'm going to take a minute to digest that, because I think the things that you touched on then are very important, and we need to come back to that. And you are listening to Word for Word Across Australia on your community radio network with Peter Forty and Sue Wilkinson, and we are talking about Alzheimer's today. Paul, in your words, can you tell us some of the behavioural things that you've noticed, or even physical, in yourself through Alzheimer's and now Parkinson's?
Well, with Parkinson's, you wonder if you've got it sometimes, because and then you look down and see your hand is shuffling around a bit, and you think, oh well, if this is Parkinson's, it's not too bad, there's no major thing, but there is.
Do you feel the shaking at all, or you just see it visually?
Bit of both. Sometimes you'll be sitting in a chair and your hand's going like crazy, and you're not even aware that it's happening, especially if there's something a little bit exciting on television or frustrating. You know, this starts jumping around.
So it moves. So more stress or more anxiety or more excitement, the movement gets bigger.
It doesn't put you into a great big thriving mess. And also it does affect your walking, because you don't, anyone walking doesn't really lift their feet, and you'll stumble, and there's nothing there really except the friction on a carpet where it'll grab your shoe a bit. It doesn't throw you down, but it's just, you're aware, you're just a bit off balance.
Paul, what about things like putting the kettle on, going to get the mail, all the day-to-day tasks?
Putting the kettle on, that never really worried me, but just recently, we've got a gas stove, and recently I've haven't turned it right off.
That's a worry, isn't it? I mean, leaving something on the stove and forgetting about it.
And you forgot to light it twice.
I admit to having done that myself.
I'm doing it already. What else have you noticed in yourself? Are there any other things that you think important to share so that anybody think, that actually applies to somebody I know or even myself?
Oh, one of the terrible things is, I do the garden and a few other things, and not things that you want to do all the time. I'm not a big garden fanatic or anything. And I used to collect stamps, rare stamps, and I love that. But now I find that I have a problem where I can't do research on them because I turn the page, there's nothing there. I turn the page and find out I've already done the research, and it's frustrating. But what else to do?
I think one of the most frustrating things sometimes is you don't know at the start of a conversation which tram you're on. You're not actually at the same place at the start of the conversation.
Yes. Mm.
For example, last night I was talking enthusiastically about coming on this program and sort of saying, well, tomorrow we're coming, and Paul looked a little bit blank at me, and I thought, hang about. What are we doing tomorrow, Paul? Oh, well, I don't know. And I said, well, we're going on to Joy. Oh, yeah, okay. So I actually have to then bring the conversation round so that we can start at the same point when we're having the conversation.
Which reminds me of one of the golden rules of radio, is you never start a sentence unless you know how it's going to finish.
Which Peter and I get wrong all the time, I think. Dr. Marie, is short-term, long-term memory loss, is it both? Does it intertwine between the both? Is it more one or more the other?
It's more short-term memory that's an issue, especially in the early stages. So what we often see is that in the early stages, people have trouble remembering new information. So Tony would have told Paul that they were coming on Joy today, maybe last week, but Paul may not store that information and keep it. But his long-term memory is probably still quite intact. He can remember everything that, happened in childhood. Well, not, we don't all remember everything, but, but as the disease progresses, what usually happens is that people start to lose some of those long-term memories as well. But it is very, very much more an issue for short-term memory.
In the case where people go back to the story of they're living in 1937 or whatever that may be, what is that related to in that sense of short-term and long-term memory? Do they stop at a certain age? Is that a normal process?
It's a very normal thing to happen in Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately. So because people can't store those new memories anymore and they're starting to lose some of their more recent memories, the things that they can think about and talk about are those things that happened in the past. And what we often see is that they gradually go further and further back into their past.
Do you find that music is the leveller for a lot of people with Alzheimer's, in the sense that the music sets their scene of where they are? You can pinpoint where they are in time?
It is for a lot of people, and, you'll see in nursing homes that they often use music and have, musical days and activities for the residents. And, music can help them to think about and remember things that happened in their past, because they link those musical memories with, their childhood or their family.
I believe some places have what they call a quiet room, is it, where they actually have not just sound, music, but light display as well, in which calms people down a lot.
Yeah, it's called a snoozelin room.
Okay.
And it's a type of therapy that's been around for quite a long time, and it uses sensory stimulation in all the senses, so sight and sound and touch, yeah.
That sounds amazing, like a sensory stimulation. Is that to maintain memory, or is that just to, I'm not sure.
To calm.
It has a number of issues. Yeah, it's calming. It gives the person something to do. So, you know, they're not just distracted by the frustrations of not being able to communicate what they want. Gives them something else to concentrate on. And it's also stimulating for their brain. So when you say maintaining memory, it's not going to, you know, do a huge amount, but it will help a little to keep their brain functioning, and we do think that does help to perhaps slow down the memory loss and other problems.
Paul, when you're communicating to Tony, do you stop mid-sentence and think, I can't remember what I was actually trying to get him to...
Often.
Quite often. It's a daily occurrence.
Yes.
Have you noticed that has progressed over the time since your initial diagnosis?
Oops.
I know.
Yes, definitely.
How do you manage that? Frustrated.
I don't know. How do I manage
it? I'm the person who then has to manage it by trying to encourage Paul to continue talking and giving him maybe some key words to think about so that he can continue. Particularly if I've got the gist of the conversation. I must say it does happen, but it is still rare that I have absolutely no idea what he's trying to get across. That doesn't ever happen. He's normally able to give me enough clues to take it from there.
Yeah, it must be frustrating for both of you.
Of course.
And Paul, how are you coping with talk? You seem pretty calm and collected. Does it affect you in any dramatic ways about how you feel about this happening to you?
Some things make me very cross. For instance, when they said I had Alzheimer's, they took my license away, and my beautiful old car had to go up the country, and you don't drive anymore, and that really hurts. It hurts me anyway. But as far as anything else, I'm not missing out on anything else. It just I miss my car. Other things, I think I handle things reasonably well. What I do if we're in a new group or meeting new people, I always the first thing I do is say, "Look, I've got a memory problem." I tell them, and sort of don't say anything else after that, and they realise, and they always talk amongst themselves when you've left the table, and when you come back it's all different. Some of them want to put you to bed and pat your head, others just ignore you because they don't want to sort of create an issue.
Now tell us the one unique way of still enjoying your lives is actually going on cruises, because it makes sense. You don't have to drive anywhere. You're in a contained environment. There's places to go, things to see, people to meet. It makes a lot of sense. Tell us about why it works for you.
Well, as you say, you've nailed it on the head.
I've answered my own question. Yeah. Stupid.
The last cruise we did was very easy because it had been on a ship that we were on before. The most important thing is we left from Melbourne... Port Melbourne, and we came back to Port Melbourne. But all this flying bit, that's really stressful for anyone.
But yet a cruise is, I guess, a bit more calming. Well,
yeah, but sometimes you might have to fly to Singapore to catch a cruise or something like that. But for the boat trip, it's worth it.
I've never been on a cruise. Have you been on a cruise, Peter?
Not really. I went on a very short cruise, but nothing of any significance.
The ferry.
No, it lasted 3 days.
Did it? Mm. I'll have to chat about that. Now, research-wise, we're getting a bit better in understanding Alzheimer's.
Oh, yes, a lot better. So the most exciting thing that's happening in research at the moment is we're going to be able to diagnose people at a much earlier stage. We know that the changes in the brain in Alzheimer's disease begin to happen decades before people actually experience any symptoms. So we're now able to detect that through things like brain scans and measuring protein levels in our what's called our cerebrospinal fluid, and hopefully one day a blood test. So we'll be able to detect it much earlier and do something about it earlier.
Let's hope so. Thank you very much for joining us today. Tony and Paul, thank you for coming in today and sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We hope that someone out there picks up the phone and calls this number if it applies to you. It's the National Dementia Helpline. It's 1800 100 500. You can also go to the Alzheimer's Australia website, which is alzheimers.org.au. Peter Forty, thank you very much for joining me today.
It's an absolute pleasure. Absolute delight.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, I would love to.
You've been listening to Word for Word Across Australia on your community radio network. Have a great day.
Bye.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
Service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.